Recording. I got backups for backups here. Okay. For better or worse, here we go. This is the beginning of the show.
A dimension of insight, a dimension of understanding. You are entering a place where reality collides with truth. There are no limits, there are no boundaries. This is Off Planet Radio.
Welcome to Off Planet Radio. My name is Randy Moggins, and this is Off Planet Radio. It is the Ides of March, and like many things, we enter into these very interesting times where events around us begin to tell us that our reality is never really what we think it is at all, and this show tonight will be no exception. We cover the areas of paranormal, parascience, deep politics, conspiracy, black science, and cryptozoology. And tonight, we're going to focus in on cryptozoology. We're going to talk about Sasquatch, Bigfoot, this strange creature that dwells around the world, I guess, but specifically here on the North American continent. I want to bring up Chris Holly. Good evening.
Good evening.
It's good,
good to be on this show.
It's good to
and
have
I'm
you back.
Really anxious to do this show. It's going to be interesting.
And so we have with us two guests tonight. Chris, go ahead and introduce the guests, give us a little bit of background, and then let's move into the subject matter.
Okay, well, my guest tonight is Mike Woolley, and along with him is his producer of a film that has been done on the Bigfoot subject, Debbie, and we will be speaking with them both. Mike came to my attention by way of another paranormal writer who knows that I have had a little problem with finding what I would consider people that I actually believed in this realm of the Bigfoot controversy, because I was, you know, spending time interviewing people and I just couldn't even write about them or want to do a radio show about them because I didn't believe them. I grew up in the country. I'm a kind of a country girl at heart, even though, you know, I've lived everywhere else as well. And I know when I hear a dog howling or even an owl crying, that's not hooting. It is not a Bigfoot. And I would get, you know, ridiculous stories told to me. And as I said, I'm a country girl. I'm like, no, you're really, you know, that's not going to get any. I can't write about that. So then I was, you know, made it public to some of my paranormal buddies that I was looking around if they ever came across a Bigfoot story that I felt they felt was, you know, really interesting, let me know. And one of them sent me this YouTube, and it was a man named Mike Woolley, and he was talking about an adventure he had while he was out hunting. which is something this man obviously does all the time, and knows his way around the woods and what's out there and how to handle yourself. I played the video and I was really taken back. I believed every word this man said to me. I could see as he described it what was going on, and I knew at once that he experienced something that was extremely strange, completely unknown, and in fact, I felt he was extremely lucky to be able to be here and tell us about what happened that day at all. So with that, I contacted Mike, and we've been, you know, chatting back and forth via the internet, and I asked him to do the show tonight, and here we are, and I am hopeful to start that Mike will tell us, as he did in that video, the experience he had with what had to be a creature that is completely unknown, or creatures, I should say. So, Mike, hello.
Hello, how you doing? Thanks for having us on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Randy, did you want to say anything before I get Mike to describe his adventure to us?
No, let's just let's go ahead and go into the narrative, because it's an interesting story. And like I said, if you've seen the YouTube video, we'll post links back to the YouTube video as well. It's always kind of interesting to be able to look in somebody's eyes and look at their faces. They're describing this. And I thought, like you did, Chris, this was a very compelling narrative.
Absolutely. I knew at once that this man experienced exactly what he was telling us. And my interest in this issue of what are these things that people are seeing in the woods really became like first on top of my list of things I need to know. And Mike, would you mind coming out here and telling everybody exactly what you did tell the world in that video, what happened to you that day and how you handled it, which I was very impressed by how you handled it, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, I'd be more than happy, Chris, Randy, to tell everybody. Back in December of 1981, I loved deer hunting, and, you know, I was in the woods every chance I could get. And I was working a evening shift at a plant next to my house, 311. And I'd get off at 11, go home, get to bed about 12, get up about 4 o'clock next morning, get about 3 hours sleep, go hit the woods, hunt, come back in around 12, get cleaned up, take a couple hours nap, go to work. I did this every day during the week. Okay. I was going to go hunting one Saturday morning and overslept. And I woke up about 9 o'clock. I was really, really mad at myself. Well, I was just PO'd. So I got to doing some chores I needed to do around the house. And I said, you know what? I'll just go hunting this afternoon, you know, get down there about 3, 4 o'clock and make an afternoon hunt, and I'll do what I need to do here at the house and still salvage, you know, some of the weekend. Well, I did so, and loaded my old truck up, headed on out to my deer stand, and went down the main highway, turned on a secondary road to the right, heading south, and I'd go down about a mile, and I would turn back left into an old logging road that was once used to get the logs out of the woods, you know, haul the logs out. Well, my stand was about, the road went about 1 mile and dead-ended in the woods. Well, I put my stand at the very end of the road, you know, because it opened up a little bit, and really good, you could see, you had a pretty good 360 around you, even though it was tight, you know, you could still see. So I would park my truck about halfway, at the halfway mark, mile mark, because I wouldn't drive down there near my stand because I didn't want to spook everything out of the woods, you know, if no one's from my truck. So I turned my truck around, heading, always tell everybody, always turn your truck around, heading out. In case you have an emergency, you can get out of there. You ain't going to be worried about turning around. So I did so and walked down there to my stand. It got on at about 3 o'clock. Temperature was about 35 degrees. Wasn't a cloud in the sky. Beautiful day. Oh, man, every bird was, you know. Well, I noticed when I got down there, you know, the temperature was pretty decent for hunting, and, you know, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. Everything was dead silent. Man, you could hear a pin off. And that kind of worried me, you know. It was like going into another dimension. So, you know, I get my stand, and I'm sitting there, I'm looking north, and, you know, I'm just, you know, how is your set, your, you know, things are just going through your mind, you know, daydreaming. And so, from the east, this little young doe come up. She must have been 40, 45, 50 pounds. And she comes up to my deer stand and just lays down. And she's soaking wet. She's been, something been running her. She was frothing at the mouth. And, you know, deer don't come your deer stand lay down. They go the other way. So I'm thinking, you know, the red song, you know, she's got a big buck running her. I'm thinking, kill me a big buck. Well, I'm looking down, okay? Well, I slowly start raising my head back up, you know. Out of a peripheral vision to the right, I saw something. And it was about 2 o'clock, and it jumped 15 to 20 feet flat-footed and landed behind another tree about 3 o'clock position. And, I mean, its back feet touched that tree when it landed. It was amazing. And I'm looking at this thing, you know, thinking, my God, you know, I got to be seeing things. And there it stood. It's between 7-8 foot tall and black, real shiny black hair. And I'm thinking, dadgum, is there a circus in town? Did a gorilla escape? No. You know, my brain asking me all kind of questions real fast. Is that some kind of hairy, feral human, you know? And it was looking at me, you know, real sincere, standing behind a tree. Must have been about 15 yards, you know, no more than 50 feet. And I'm looking to the right, you know, my shoulder, 3 o'clock at it. And we're having a stare down. And I first thing hit my mind, it might have been somebody dressed up in a gorilla suit, because back then we hunted on these big timber companies' land. You know, they owned several thousand acres. You know, your Pacific Northwest timber companies down own a lot of land down in the south. You know, Boise Cascade, Vancouver Plywood, Willamette, and they would let us hunt on their land, but it's first come served, you know, first served basis. You know, well, three, four years after that, they started charging people. You know, people would form a hunting club, get members, and members pay $250, $300 a year, and they would get to hunt, and it was posted, nobody could get in there, but that hadn't got here yet, okay? But back then, they would if somebody wanted the stand that you were hunting on, they would do their best to either tear it down, try to scare you out, or something, you know? And that's what first hit my mind. I said, they're trying to scare me out of my deer stand, you know? And so I said, that's it. That's what's going on. So I start talking to this thing. And I told him, I said, look, you got to scare me off my deer stand. Take that head off and get the hell out of here, you know. And so he's looking at me. And one thing that come across my mind is where he come from was nothing but briars. It was a thicket. I tried to get back there to check, you know, on the deer, well, how they were running. It was so thick and so tight, I couldn't get back there. I tried. I could not walk back there. But he come through that mess. And that told me something right then. Hey, something ain't right here, okay? So, this thing, we keep going on, and I'm looking at the thing, and he's getting more sincere, and his eyes are really evil, very satanic, mean. And it was like he could see in my body and read it, you know. Just, I got real nauseated. My throat got real dry. My stomach was rolling and tore up. And, you know, my knees were knocking and my teeth were rattling, as people say, you know. So, anyway, I keep thinking, please come on, just leave, just leave, just leave, you know, and he wouldn't do it. So he's watching me real close, up and down, up and down. And he looks at that rifle in my hands. I can't see him a lot looking at that gun. And he gave me the vibes that he was no sense afraid of me, okay? And if I wanted war, he was ready, you know. And he made me feel I had a 270 deer rifle, and a very powerful deer rifle down here in the South. And he made me feel like it's a BB gun, okay? He was a young adult male, really in good shape, big pectoral muscles, flat stomach, 3 7 8 foot tall, 400 to 500 pounds. So I take my rifle, I look through my scope at him, I said, you know, this sucker looks real human, you know, I know I shoot it, because I might be shooting a feral human, or I don't know. So anyway, I looked through my scope, and, you know, man, it was just, there it was. I mean, I looked at his face, I could see his eyelashes, I could see his eyes moving, I could see the steam, you know, a cold day when you're breathing, the steam coming out of your nostrils and your mouth, and it was doing that. I said, oh, my God, you know, I'm in a situation here. Well, he gets real mad, and it's on. I mean, after what I pulled of that gun, he went ballistic. He was grabbing that tree, shaking that tree. He was getting froggy on me, you know, kind of like a splinter does. I said, it's on, he's going to get me now. And all of a sudden, a whistle comes back from the northeast from him, and real shrill. And he looks over there at it, and he turns back, he looks at me, and he whistles back while he's looking at me. And I said, oh, my God. I said, I have heard that whistle in the woods 1,000 times, but I always thought it was a bird. You know? All of a sudden, I hear movement coming my way. Whatever whistles him is bipedal, and it's walking to him. Well, he looks over at me and kind of grins, kind of sheepish grin. And I'm thinking, I got to get out of here. I'm fixing to die, you know. And I had a lot of things in my mind, my wife. I had a little boy. He was young, 4 or 5 years old. I thought I'd never see him again. And I was on a ladder stand. It's kind of like a regular ladder with a seat on it. You lean up against a tree. And I had a big old chain lock on it. And I wonder if I could steal it over the top. So I start my way down the ladder. I'm shaking so bad, you know. It's just, I don't know. Well, I get down to the ground, and my legs don't even want to hold me up. I'm just that scared. Each one of my legs felt like it weighed a couple hundred pounds. But I was 25, 26 years old, good shape, young, you know. So I headed west to my deer stand. And I'm trying to run as fast as I can. I'm a half mile of that truck. I hear something, bam, boom, boom, bam. I looked over to the left, and Bigfoot is overflanking me. He's running down, he's running through the woods. I'm running on a logging road. He's about 50, 30, 40, 50 feet from me, but he's in the woods, and he is knocking down trees. He is bulldozing trees down. Limbs, brush. I see his arms just throwing it out of the way. I said, oh my God. Yeah, I've had it. Another thing that scared me, I said, you know, when I get to my truck, is there going to be some up there waiting for me? And I only had four bullets in my gun. And, you know, the chances are when you're panicking, how many can you take out? And if you hit one, you're only going to make it matter. So, we're running, and I'm coming up on my truck. And he's standing up there with me, and I'm thinking, yeah, he's going to get me because I got to stick my key in ignition and unlock the truck to get in it. Well, when I get to the tailgate of the truck, I swing around to the left, and I fired a warning shot. I didn't fire a shot to hit him. I popped a shot off, you know, try to slow him down, you know, where I could get in the truck. And the bullet hit about 7 foot, 7.5 foot off the ground, hit a pine tree in front of his face, about 3 foot in front of his face. If he had been another second, the bullet probably would have caught him in the head, been a head shot. And I get in the old truck, and I crank it up, and I'm peeling out of there. And I look in my rearview mirror, and I did not know it. But the one that whistled to him, the first one, was coming up behind me. I didn't have one chasing me. I had two.
Oh, God.
Well, they come up together where I was parked. They come running up there together. And I see them look at each other, and they look back at me. I come on home, and I was really tore up, really, you know, just, I didn't know what to do. I couldn't talk to nobody because I didn't know nobody think that I was crazy. So, but a week later, I went over and to a friend's house. He lives directly across the road from there, probably a couple miles. And I said, I need to go get a deer stand, and would you go help me get it? He said, which one is it? And I told him, he said, you need help? He said, I need no heavy deer stand. You can get back there. You need me? I said, well, I just like to have a company, you know, go ride with him. And we go back there, and that deer stand, it was a pretty heavy pipe deer stand, okay, welded up. And what I do, I back my truck up to that tree and pushed it up back of the truck against the tree and pulled it up, you know, against the tree. Somebody had took that deer stand, like they tried to break it off the tree, but they couldn't because I had a big chain and lock up the top. That stand was wrapped around that tree like a vine. I mean, completely wrapped around two or three turns.
Oh,
and
you're saying that stand was metal?
Yes, sir. It was a lean-to deer stand, okay? What that is, it's a ladder, and on the top, it's got a plywood seat with a V-cut in it, and you just lean it up against a tree and take your chain and chain it to it, you know, to steady it. Well, what I did, I had the ladder custom-made. A friend of mine made it for me, I worked with. And he made it a steel pipe, and I mean, the stand was heavy. What I would do, I would take my pickup truck, and drive back up to the tree, get as close as I could with the tailgate down, and get in the back of the truck with a friend, and help me, we would pick it up, and set it up against the tree, and pull out. Well, what I'd take, I'd put a lock, I kept a big chain and a lock on the stand up at the top of the tree. You know, the chain worked did two purposes. Kept somebody from stealing the deer stand. Number two, it kept the deer stand in place steady while I was sitting on it. Well, I went over to a friend's house. His name is Wayne. And I asked him, I said, Wayne, would you come back here and help me get my deer stand, you know? And he lived about 2.5-3 miles away. And he said, what's wrong? Is it wet back there? You can't get back there? He said, it seems like it's pretty dry. You know, he said, you need me? I said, well, I just like to have a company. You know, I wouldn't have told him I was going back there by myself, you know. So we went back there, my old truck, and we got back there, and my deer stand was wrapped around that tree like a vine growing on it. It blew me away. And Wayne's a big old boy. He's about 6'8", 6'9", 400 pounds. He's pretty big. And he broke out of sweat. And he said, good God, what happened here? I said, Mike, are you telling me the true story? I said, Wayne, I don't know. Something had took that deer stand. And they wanted it off the tree. But up at the top, I had a great big heavy chain and a big lock, and they couldn't break. What they did, they grabbed the stand. Yeah, it must have been several of them because 6 or 7 good, strong, professional wrestlers could not have done what was done to this stand. Wayne was looking at it. He said, you know, he said, they couldn't have got a four-wheeler in here. They couldn't have got a pickup truck. It would have took a strong four-wheel drive pickup truck to hook to that stand and drove around the tree. And he said, you can't do it because, he said, it's too tight. There's other trees in here. And, it was spooky. And it was, again, you could hear a pinfall. The air felt like it had a little static electricity. And he said, let's get out of here. some ain't right, you know. So we left, and he was kind of tore up about it. I mean, we got back to his house, and I could tell his mind was going through a lot. And, of course, I wasn't going to say nothing because in my heart, I kind of knew what did it. And I just didn't – I was already down and out about it, you know, beat up. And that really didn't help nothing seeing that deer stand, what was done to it. It was just like a message, you know, like tacking a big sign on a tree. You know, you come back, you're dead. You know, that's the way I looked at it. So anyway, I left there. And over the long-term years deer hunting, I've seen some Bigfoot sneaking through the woods. I've seen mama's baby and daddy. I seen one day. I was on my deer stand, and there was this humongous cedar tree. And about noon, all of a sudden, this cedar tree just opened up. You know, and it was probably 30, 40 feet around. The limbs went all the way down to the bottom. And this Bigfoot just comes out of there. And I'm like, my God. And I'm getting to thinking, what in the world, you know? So I thought, I got to go by there. I walked right by there that morning, and he was in there. He didn't grab me. And I'm thinking, I got to go right back by there on the way out. So I wanted to hunt about 5:30. You know, like I said, get on deer stand at 5 in the morning. I stayed there 5 at night, 6 when you got to come out. And so about 2 o'clock, I said, man, I got to go. I can't take it. I ain't coming out here dark. Well, I walked over to the tree, and I took my rifle, and I stuck it kind of up the tree and pulled some, I had my gun on fire in case there was another one in there, and I pulled some limbs back. And what they were doing, you know, I'd come in there about 5 o'clock in the morning, feel my way through there, get on my stand, sit down, and it'd be 7 o'clock before you could see anything daylight because I wouldn't even noise and my scent to die down, you know, where you would spook the animals. Well, some mornings I would jump turkeys. Turkeys would be in that big cedar tree roosting, you know, and they just gobble, 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 wings flapping, man, it was all hell breaking loose. It'd make your heart feel like it would blow out of your chest. Now, what he was doing, I pulled some limbs back, and he had gotten there and broke him a few limbs off where he could get in there enough and hide, and nobody could see him, and as those turkeys were coming in to roost in the evening, he would grab them. Well, I saw 2 big butt prints where something had been sitting down on the ground, okay? On the right side, facing south, there was a great big, meticulously neatly stacked pile of feathers. On the left side was a big, meticulously stacked pile. And I mean, the bones weren't scattered. They were just stacked neatly. And so he was catching turkeys, killing them, and eating them right there. He had him a game plan because, man, it was a pile of feathers. I don't know how many it was there. Big old pile of bones. And so I left that area. That was about... I was hunting a game reserve of several.
Can you put that on a timeline for me, Mike, when that occurred?
Yeah, 81 was the when the two of them chased you, right?
Okay.
And when did you find this, like, hunting nest of this other guy?
Okay, I didn't hear you there, Chris. I barely heard you.
In 1981 is when the two big animals chased you.
Right, correct.
And now when did this happen where you found this, like, hunting nest of the Bigfoot? What year was
this
that?
This happened about 7 miles to the southwest of where the two chased me out of the woods. The next year, the next deer hunting season.
So it was like 82. So they were there during this time period.
Right, right.
Okay.
There's a lot of people. When everybody started coming out around 99, all your shows come on, Mysterious Encounters, Autumn Williams, and, you know, all the other shows. I was looking at a Bigfoot research operation report. I read the reports, you know, people would write in. And there was some old man wrote in that lived 2 miles from where I got run out of the woods. And he told the BFRO he would take his little dog out at night to use the bathroom. and he took him out one night. And he said there was something standing there. I must have been 30, 40 foot from the thing. And my storage building, he was standing next to my storage building, and his head was a little higher than the edge of the building. And he said the building was 8 foot. And said he was looking at me real seriously. And I didn't have no gun. And he said the thing stunk real bad, like a wet horse, you know. And he said I run back inside to get my gun and got my dog, and I come back out, and he was walking. I could hear him walking in the woods. Well, I jumped up. My wife was in bed, and I said, "Here, read this." And I said, "You see there?" I said, "I was not seeing things, you know." And I felt it was like a ton, 100 tons of brick come off my back when I read that. It did a lot. It helped me out, you know, because I thought I was losing my mind, you know.
And, exactly where was this area? Where is this area that all this took place, Mike?
This happened about 75, 80 miles south of Shreveport, Louisiana, on Highway 171 between Mannions and Wally, Louisiana. It happened about 4 miles west of Manny, Louisiana.
And I would take it that there's not many people living in this area.
Well, there's been a lot of houses come in there because the timber is being cut, and they're cutting the timber, and the creature's habitat is being wiped out. I mean, your cities are growing and they're moving out, you know, and the timber's being cut, a lot of oil field work going on, and they're tearing the land up, a lot of logging going on, they're tearing land up. And so we're kind of doing to the Bigfoot what we did to the Indians, you know, a couple hundred years ago.
Just pushing them out.
Pushing them out.
Yeah.
That kind of comes into a very interesting area that I wanted to touch on as well. First off, before I hit on the second part, let me ask you this, Mike.
Okay.
When you were out in the woods and you, both times, both encounters where you had these encounters with these beings, did you detect any smells in the area?
No. One day, I went hunting, got on my deer stand, and I smelled something horrible.
Okay.
Probably real bad.
Like sulfur, maybe?
Yeah, I smelled it within 150 feet of my deer stand. And I got real bad because I said, you know what? Somebody got on my deer stand, shot a deer under my deer stand, killed a deer, and field dressed it. And what I mean by field dressed is when you take the guts out of it.
I'm very familiar with that, yes.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought. Well, I got to looking around. I didn't find nothing. But the smell stayed. And so, you know, I had it 2 or 3 hours. I didn't see nothing. And I went home. I got up the next morning. I must have been about 5 o'clock when I left the deer stand that evening. And I got back out there at 5, 6 o'clock the next morning. There was no smell. I mean, nothing. It was clean, clear. And that kind of blew my mind, you know. I said, "Dadgum, I guess that was the coyotes during the night must have come up and eat the guts, you know, while I was gone." But I never suspected it was a Bigfoot.
Okay.
Mike, I was wondering that back in 81, 82, when all this was taking place, you believe that these animals were living there in that wooded area and that was their home territory? And if that's so, did you ever come across anything like a campsite, you know, or an animal den or anything like that besides the feathers where you saw the thing eating? Did you find anything else that looked like they were actually living in the area? Or do you think that they were passing through or what? Because first let me ask you those questions and I'll go on from there.
Okay. Well, no, I really didn't think so. I didn't think about any of them living there because, you know, I heard what went on in California back in the 60s and I thought, you know, that was a bunch of bull, and I thought it was people making up money to store to make money, but But no, I really didn't. The only thing that ever happened to me that I was out exploring around, and I stayed in the woods all year long. Squirrel season, any season, I was in the woods hunting. And I was in the woods, even though it wasn't deer season, I'd go out, check my stands, and I would get up during the summer months and spend time in my deer stand and look around and watch the deer and let the deer see me, get used to it. Because when they see a deer stand and nothing on it, you know, they're smart enough to know that, hey, something ain't right. Well, then they see a body, you know, and get to thinking, you know, something surely ain't right. Well, that's how I used to do. But I got down one day by the creek. Like I said, it was really, really tight. You couldn't hardly get through. And I saw this humongous set of footprints, kind of in the sand. And I got to follow them. They went about 20 feet, and they disappeared. I said, where in the heck did this thing go? You know, I'm thinking, good God. You know, but anyway, to make a long story short, I went on down the creek, and on the other side, the footprints come out of the creek and up the bank. This creature, in order to throw somebody off tracking him, he got down in the creeks. And he went down about three-quarters of a mile in the creek and come out and went on across the creek. That's the only thing that ever spooked me to make me think that there was somebody else there. And back when my dad was living, I took him, he loved a squirrel hunt, and I took him back at a squirrel hunt, and he told me, he said, and he was a long time hunter, and he was a good hunter, and he told me, he said, you know, something ain't right here. He said, I got this bad feeling, he said, you can hear a pinfall here, and he said, we're not gonna kill no squirrels. He said, let's get out of here. I mean, you know, he didn't like it, but, I never did see no, I didn't get off my stand, look around, because you spooked the deer, you know, and I put out a lot of smell, and, you know, but other than that, that those tracks getting in the creek and coming out 3/4 mile down the creek, that kind of, they got me to thinking, you know, this, whatever did this is real smart, because it wanted to throw me off, its tracks, you know, and, you know, like I said, I lived in the woods, 40, 50 years hunting, and, I wasn't bad, you know, on figuring stuff out.
Yates? Go on, Randy.
Well, what I was going to ask is, Mike, the second part of my question was, did you get any sense when you were up in that deer stand with Bigfoot in your vicinity? You said that the air was very still, that there was no animal sounds, there was no bird sounds. Did you by any chance happen to note the atmosphere? Was there an electrical component or anything that would be what we would call an atmospheric shift?
Okay, let me tell you what happened to me. I have a nerve disease called RSD. I had surgery back in 1999. I had tendonitis, elbow, and a carpal tunnel syndrome. And what happened? My arm felt like it was in a vice, and you know, I had to take medicine for it, and I went back to the doctor, and he said it didn't work, so he went in back in and did two more surgeries. That didn't work. And about 3 months later, he said, you got RSD. I said, what is RSD? I said, it's reflux sympathetic dystrophy. When a part of your body gets hurt, you know, whether it's a finger, a hand, an arm, a toe, whatever, your brain sends signals to that part of your body to hurt.
That's right.
Now, you know, when you have surgery and you wake up for a few days, you're sore and you hurt. Well, that's the way I feel most of all the time, because my body is sending, the brain is sending signals to my arm to hurt. Well, I take medication and nerve blocks, stuff like that, to deal with it. And I have some days I have electrical feeling going through my arm, but it feels like it's off my arm a little bit, but I could feel the shock. I felt that day. 1981, I felt that all over my body with that thing. His eyes was, everybody says, what scared you the most? The big body? I said, no, his eyes. I said, his eyes scared me the most. I mean, man, he wanted me dead. And
what color were his eyes, Mike?
Go ahead.
What color were the eyes? Do you remember?
His eyes were brown.
They were brown.
Brown.
See, that's...
brown or black, you know, that's the best I can make out.
That's the question that always stumps me, and the answers that I've gotten so far when I've asked other people that, you know, are investigating Bigfoots, never satisfied me. Is now you just explained to us that was what was stalking you and going after you, which is what it was doing, hunting you, was a very healthy, big, strong, huge animal. Intelligent animal, obviously, that can communicate with other animals just like them. That would take a lot of food and water and just some type of shelter, something, to get him to flourish to that point, not to mention two or a group or a family of them or a clan of them. Now, but the thing that bothers me is we never seem to be able to find a area where they're living or eating enough to support that type of group or scat or anything from them. Yet they are there. People see them. Now, people say to me, oh, well, that's because we don't know the wilderness and it's so big and we don't know what's back there. But I'm sorry, they're not seeing them in the middle of the wilderness. They're seeing them in places like you saw them, where there are humans around and humans living near campsites. And I've had lots of people tell me that they've been sighted Bigfoots around the logging roads, which I think maybe it just makes it easier for them to access the area by using these old logging roads. I don't know. But my question is it at all possible, am I totally crazy to think that they possibly are put here or put down in the area where you saw them and dealt with them for a matter of time to maybe hunt or gather or just run around in the woods, whatever it is they do, and then taken somewhere else, be it through a dimensional thing or an alien type thing or even a government project thing where they let them out and then take them back? Because I can't figure out why we can't find more substance of them living and breeding and eating and, you know, relieving themselves and everything else that doesn't exist, yet they do exist. They saw them. I believe every word you told me. I think they were hunting you. But then they just, like you say, seem to disappear.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you think about that?
Well, first off, I've thought about that over and over, what you just said. What are these things and where do they come from? When I die and I meet the good Lord, the first thing I'm going to ask him after he gets through questioning me, I'm going to ask him about the Bigfoot. What are these things? You know, but anyway, getting back to that story. You know, I've read articles. They come over this land bridge or something over the Bering Sea. They come from Asia. Their cousin is Gigantopithecus, and I'm holding more true to that because, you know, the Indians wrote stories 1,000 years ago. They found on a wall about these creatures, and the Indians said that they weren't trustworthy. You know, the Indians tried dealing with them. You know, tried being friends with them. But they couldn't trust them because they would come in at night and steal fish out of their nets, do what they wanted to do. They weren't trustworthy, you know. And but they've been here a long, long time. I do know that. So far as spaceships and stuff like that, I don't think they come from you know, above, because. A friend of mine has 1,500 acres down below me, about 4 miles from my house. And they're crawling down there like cattle. They're everywhere. And they've even come out, you know, he can be driving down the road and just chase you. He'll chase you out, run down the road. And he had some guys down there hunting one day. And one guy, a military guy, supposed to be pretty good with a rifle, saw one. He shot him in the back. And he took off, and everybody got to chasing the thing, trying to find him. Well, there was a log that was across the creek, and you run across that, and when they got to that point, they found blood and guts all over forever. So they bagged it all up, called a scientist, and sent it to a couple of labs, and it come back ape.
They came back ape?
Ape. So, you know, they say we're kin to chimpanzees, our DMZ is in them. Okay? So, that right there told me that he's breathing the same air we breathe. He's got blood in him, and he bleeds just like the way we bleed. So, I think this is just a creature that has never been discovered because they're so elusive. I've seen them on their stand. When one walking through the woods, he would walk about 20 foot, get behind a tree, and stay there a little while. He'd look, make sure, you know, he'd move up again to another tree. And the minute he heard something, he would automatically just grab it, he'd get up against that tree, and he would blend into that tree. And if I blinked my eyes and looked off and then turned back, I couldn't see him. He just automatically got himself up against that tree and blended into the tree. You couldn't see him. And I said, that right there is what they've been doing. That's how they've been eluding people. That's one of their deals. You know, you might walk right by one and not even know it. You know?
Yeah. And do you think that once they do deal with people a little bit, they just withdraw and go deeper into areas where there are no people? Mm-hmm. And that's how they are continuing?
Mm-hmm. The only thing bothering me, I've been getting reports and studies. I have some friends down in Natchitoches, and they have just about replaced one back door on their house. I went down there, Debbie went down there with me, and seen the tracks. Matter of fact, I've seen a couple of them down there. One of them's a 9-footer. And he just tore one door off her house trying to get in. And that bothers me. I don't like that, okay? You know, if I had a bunch of land, maybe on my property, if they stayed in the back, didn't bother my cows, you know, they take people's cows up. A lady called me here last week crying. She said, read it. She said one night, her cow, she said anytime one of her cows was going to give birth, she would put it in the barn, okay? You know, where you have birth with a calf. She heard a ruckus, and she went out to her barn, and this Sasquatch come out of the barn holding a calf, taking the calf. There's two of them. So she went in the barn, and the poor old mama cow, they had twisted her head off. Now, why? Why do that? Take the calf and leave. Why did they have to kill that poor innocent cow? If that would have been my place, my farm, and I used to be in a farming business, I used to produce 3.5 million chickens a year, cows too, back in the 90s. And I had a lot of stuff going on at my chicken houses at night. Something would take, when the lights was out, and the curtains was up, we just had that wire, you know, going down the side to keep the chickens in. Something would stick its fingers in the wire, and a man couldn't do it. He wasn't strong enough. It was coated wire. And pull it back and reach in and grab a chicken, and we could see where they pulled the chicken out of the house through the wire because there would be feathers, you know, on the wire. And it would take and try to put the wire back like it was nothing happened, you know, try to mat it back together. And so, but it didn't dawn on me what possibly could be. And we're out rural, you know, country, and I had a pit in the back dug about 10 foot wide, 20 foot deep, and I throw the dead ones in. And I'd go back there, and something would give them, I don't know how it would do it, the pit was 20 foot deep. Chickens would be in a bottom pit, and there'd be chickens laying up on the ground, throw back out, and sometimes I see coyotes eat them, walking, taking the chickens off. But it was slick enough, you know, it would mat the wire back, trying to keep me from. He wouldn't leave a gaping hole. But I don't trust him. Like I said, if I would have saw him come out of my barn and took my calf and killed my cow, I'd have got my guns and some people and got the dogs, and I would track him down and kill him. because I do not believe taking a calf was one thing, okay? What made me mad was killing an innocent cow. And I've seen them do horses, killing horses out in the field. Why? You know, it's just meanness. And that right there, I can tolerate a lot and overlook a lot. But when you start killing innocent animals, not only are you losing that property, you're losing income, you're losing money. That really makes me mad to see that happen.
Well, I think the more interesting point about it too, Mike, is this sounds like a creature with enough intelligence to be mean. To be malicious, which is not the sign of what you see in the animal kingdom for the most part, unless you've got an animal that's got rabies or an animal that's been abused or is in some way, you know, obviously not in its normal order. This sounds like a very intelligent and very mean creature, almost like human.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I think these things, they're a lot smarter than some humans, I know. And getting back to the strength, their strength is ungodly. You won't believe, you take a cow, a 1,000-pound cow, or a 1,200-pound horse, and just twist the neck off of it. Down the road here, this lady's got this, she had a couple of big Rottweilers, and they're bumping 150 pounds apiece.
Yeah.
And they're not far from where my friend's land is, you know, where that they shot that Bigfoot that day. She went out in her backyard one day. She, you know, it's morning comes, she didn't hear a dog. You know, he usually barks in the morning. You know, kids going by, school bus going by. And she had him on chains. And that dog was, his head was still hooked up on the dog collar around his chain, throwed over the clothesline, wrapped around about three times. There was a chain with a collar and a dog head, and the dog's body was laying about 50 feet from there. Now, tell me what did that.
Wow.
How come, Mike, I'm not hearing a lot of this out in the other, like, I'm going to call it the Bigfoot community? I don't hear a lot of the truth that you're telling us now as to how dangerous and these things are killers, because you don't kill a cow, a horse, or a dog, you know, as Randy pointed out, for enjoyment like they're doing, unless you're an intelligent animal that's evolved to the point of being able to figure out all that stuff and develop this killer instinct, and it's like for its entertainment. Why is it that we don't hear a lot more about this? Because obviously the people out there in the open country that are dealing with these things, they know this. But people like me living on Long Island, I don't hear a lot about this part of it. Why is that?
Well, I do a lot of looking on Facebook and the web, and you've got a lot of people out there, groups, that they idolize these things. I mean, it's like Bigfoot's a god to them now. Y'all read that. Y'all seen that. Don't shoot the Sasquatch. I'm a firm believer. Don't shoot him, okay? But I guarantee you, if I had to do over again, and if it come down to me and him, one of us is going to die that day, I sure try to make sure he died, okay? And I think anybody else would do the same thing that I'm saying. But people underestimate these things. Don't mess with them, okay? Everybody asks me, well, what am I do if I go out in the woods and I run into one, okay? Don't make eye contact with a thing, because that's how he feeds off of you. I mean, he can read you. Don't point at him. I mean, by God, if you got a gun, don't point at him. And trust me, when there's one, there's a dozen more. If I was shot that one that day, not only would I have his buddy, but it ain't going to tell him how many more. They swarmed in there on me, and that would have been it. Okay? I read about people feeding them. Going out up in the mountains, the Pacific Northwest, where those things are humongous, 10, 12 foot tall. They're feeding them. They're camping out with them. There's not enough money in the world you can get me to do that. Because if you could have been in my shoes that day, and seen the teeth. He clicked his teeth, showed his teeth to me about 20 times. And he clicked them at me. And I was talking to Autumn Williams' mother, Sally. I said, Sally, what do you think he meant? He kept showing me his teeth. She said, Mike, she said, you were at the final. She said, you were at the railroad track. She said, somebody was fixing to get hurt bad. She said, when they do that, it's on. I mean, they're getting ready for battle. So, but, you know, I think nobody, I don't think they should kill one or shoot one, okay? Not unless your life's, he's trying to kill you, you've hurt your family. But what bothers me is killing innocent dogs, cats, livestock, people's pets. They have no business coming up around people's house at night, looking in the windows. None of that business. Now, they got to run a property. Do what they need to do, but leave the people alone. Leave the human people alone.
Do they leave the people alone, Mike? Or do you think that there's a lot of cases of missing people in the woods that went by way of the hand of the Bigfoot?
I've read tons of stories, okay, about people coming missing. And after my encounter, I thoroughly believe that something don't smell right here, okay? It really makes me wonder because, you know, when a deer dies, when you shoot a deer, you make a bad kill, make a bad shot. He's gonna go somewhere to the gnarliest thicket he can get in, and he's gonna hide. Unless you got a dog to track him where he went down, you're not gonna find that deer. Okay? In the same way with bears and everything else. I never hear anybody say, "Well, I was out in the woods and I found this bear skeleton." You know, you don't hear that. I'm sure sometimes it happens, but you don't hear about that same place where this is. I got run on my deer stand. I shot a beautiful 7-point buck. Deer weighed about 225 pounds right off my stand. I could hit him with a rifle. He was close. One shot, fell dead. I went to my truck, get my truck half a mile away, back my truck back down there, got back 20 minutes. I was gone 20 minutes. Deer gone. No deer. Got out of my truck. I said, wait a minute. Deer was dead. The deer was not drug off, okay? No drag marks, nothing. Something picked my deer up, toted it off. Now, what did that? And there was nobody hunting for miles around me. There was only one way in, the way I come in, and one way out.
No, it's a very frightening mystery, and I just don't know what to make of it. This is something I really have to digest, and it's just not like normal to me. There's like so many questions that you bring up about these animals that just don't like fit right to me. Why is it that we can't catch one, Mike? I know that we've had some experienced hunters go out after them and try to trap them and everything else all over the world, yet they constantly come up empty-handed. Are these animals so much smarter than these, you know, trained hunters that they can evade us constantly and just never get caught? Or is it, I still think they like disappear and come back. I don't know what to think. I don't know how to even phrase it, but it's not like they are permanently here to me. It's like they come and go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that to me is the part that is more as frightening as what you're describing, which is scary enough. Add that on to it, and this is just a huge mystery. But why is it that you think they'll take all this money and find all these really experienced hunters and their dogs and everything else, and they go out and they live out there and nothing? They can't even get a whiff of one of these things.
Well, Chris, anytime you are born and raised in an area, say the Sasquatch, you're born and raised in the woods, okay? That's their house, that's their backyard. It's the same as a human. You know your house like the back of your hand, okay? First off, these people are going out there doing that. They're not going to kill one. They're not going to see one. I'm not trying to be rude or nothing. These creatures are a step ahead of you. They see you when you drive up. They see you when you get out of your car. They see you when you're putting those cameras out. They see you when they're putting that bait out. They signal each other in the woods. I have heard them talking before in the woods. Do you remember years ago when we were kids, when people would have throat cancer, and they had these things, these machines they would stick up to their throat, and it sounded like a robot when they talked? Do you remember
yes,
that?
Yes, yes, yes.
That's what they sound like. That's exactly what they sound like.
Oh, my goodness.
They're not gonna catch one, because if they did catch one in a snare or a pin, the other ones would come in, tear the thing down, and get it out. They're way ahead of the game. Very highly intelligent. Everybody says, "Well, Mike, how would you go about catching one good one if you wanted to, you know, do something, take some pictures or something?" Well, first off, all these people that got to catch one, they got all these camera crews with them. They got 40, 50 people. Now, going in the woods, toting ice chests, banging noise, making noise, smell everywhere. That's something deer hunting. You've got to kill your smell. Special soap I used to use to take a bath in. I had a big plastic box. I put my hunting clothes in. I put pine straw in there. Left them in my truck all week long. When I got to where I was going hunting, I'd take my clothes off. I'd put them on. When I got through hunting, I'd take my clothes off, put them back in put a pine straw. A lot of guys, this is where a lot of guys mess up. They get up in the morning, go in the deer stand, they're going to stop by the Greasy Spring restaurant, all we're going to eat a big breakfast and drink coffee, then go to the deer stand. What you're doing, you're taking everybody's scent in the restaurant. Not only are you taking all that grease and sausage and all that, you're taking that to the woods. When you get to the woods, the deer smell about 2 miles away, they're gone. You're going to sit out there and freeze to death for nothing. Deer
hunting
is scientific, okay? Just like Bigfoots are.
Yeah, we're not savvy enough to be on their level to get in order to see them in their natural state. You know, Mike, I had a friend many, many years ago who was a soldier of fortune, and one of his missions was up in the wilderness, I think it was in Canada, and he was dropped down there at the time. I think they were looking into the oil pipelines or whatever it was at the time. And they were dropped in the middle of the wilderness, and these were these trained killers, these soldiers. And they said that he told me, and it was only like a group of like, I think 20 men. And they were sent down in this wilderness to look it all over for the mission that they were sent for, whatever it might have been. And they said that they were followed the entire time, and it was tree knocks and rocks being thrown at them constantly. And at night, the only way they could get rest was to build a circle of fire. And they would be in the middle of it, the soldiers, with two or three men with automatic weapons, taking shifts watching so the other men could sleep. And the whole time, they had rocks thrown at them, and they were banging on the trees and howling. And I, you know, always thought that was a horrible, and they couldn't wait to get out of there and get away from that mission. And they went in and out of where they were along an old abandoned logging road, which is interesting to me, too. So they felt that they were afraid of the fire, and that they knew that their weapons were so powerful that they could take down six or seven each men if they were being charged, because they had these big machine guns with them. But what do you think of that story?
Well, it sounds like it's Bigfoot's found, because they're notorious for throwing rocks, sticks. I've had rocks thrown at me. I've had big limbs thrown at me. And I looked up the trees, you know, I thought it was hickory nuts or acorns falling and whatnot. Well, none. I walk a little ways and bam, a limb hit behind me or a rock hit me. And I've had stuff following me out here in the woods. I'd take two steps, it'd take two steps. I'd take four steps, it'd take four steps. I look, I didn't see nothing. And I continue walking on, and he'd do it, and I'd stop. Well, I looked around and said, so one day I said, "Dadgummit, I can see your body, but I'll fix you." I laid my gun down on the ground, and I got flat on my stomach. And I was looking ground, just 6 inches above the ground, from where that were the noise was coming. I said, "I'll see your feet. I'll see your legs, okay?" So I couldn't see them, nothing. And so that always puzzled me. What was doing that? And now I know what was doing that. They do not want you in the woods. That's their area. They looked at me that day when that little doe they were chasing for hours. That was their food for the day, for the night. And I blew that. They didn't get it. They were mad, number one, they were mad at me about that. Number two, they were mad at me because I was in their house. Okay. The one that engaged me was a young male, probably early 20s. Humongously built, looked like a bodybuilder. I've got a friend over in Norway, Tron Osham, and he gets tickled because he heard me say one day they were built for business, and he loves that cachet. He loves it. You know, he kills about it all the time. And but if you could have seen that thing going through that brush, bulldozing it, and the way he was swinging his arms, breaking stuff, I could hear him more. You know, I mean, man, I was, I thought the end was near.
They seem to be very angry animals. They really do. They do not want to cohabit with us, that's for sure. And they antagonize, too.
I mean, it's just best not to, if you're in the woods and see one, just, you know, just try to ease out there best you can and don't shoot it. Be cool. And, try not to keep no trouble, and don't go back and tell everybody there's a Bigfoot. I saw a Bigfoot over here because there'll be a swarm of people go over there, and it's just going to create more trouble. It's just leave them alone. You know, if they ain't bothering you, don't bother them. You know, but the only problem I would have if they come on my farm killing my cows and horses, we would have a problem. Okay, but other than that, I believe. Live and let live,
Wow. Randy?
Anything else that you want to ask, or Mike, you want to add to the narrative?
Well, it's, I guess the only thing that I would say is be safe in the woods. If you see one of these creatures, don't gauge it. Just back out if you can, real easy, real slow. Don't run. And as soon as you get out of sight, get your car, and most chances are that creature, that could be a den area or something near there, you know, a habituation area. I mean, I don't know. But I got apprehended by a hunting party, and Dr. Grover Krantz, a scientist from Washington State, I'm a big fan of his. I read a lot of his books. And a man died 10 years ago. And he said, he explained something that I wondered about. He answered a question about these rogue males that I run into that run me on my deer stand. He said, what happens, you'll have a clan of these things, a family, about six of them. And he says, a male loves to have about three or four female friends. So his, you know, his property, nobody touches. Well, in that clan of six, seven, you might have two juveniles, youngsters, you know, growing up. And as soon as they get, you know, grown up, you know, start breeding, time to leave the clan, the male will push them out. The older male will push them out. He'll run them off because he don't want a competition. Now, the only way that young male will be able to stay is if he can put a whipping, and I mean a good whipping on that older male, and run him off, okay? Most of the time that don't happen. The young one has to hit the road. Well, okay, there you go. You've got a rogue male. He's mad, you know. He's out there searching. Now, what he's got to do, he's got to get out there and find him another clan that will accept him and let him in. But what he's going to do, he's going to get out there and look around, and he's going to find him a clan with some older dominant alpha male that he feels like he can whip and run out of there. Well, he'll keep searching until he can find that clan, and when he does, he'll run that older male out, and then he will start a chain of living with that clan. That's what Dr. Grover Clint said, and I thoroughly believe that. the man is 100% right.
Well, it's an amazing story, and it adds a lot of information to something that continues to be a very deep mystery, the Sasquatch Bigfoot mystery. As we're kind of going through this, sitting in the background with us on the interview tonight also is the co-producer, co-writer of the movie that actually features Mike. It's called Skookum, the Hunt for Bigfoot. And the film is set, I believe, for spring release. So, Debbie King McMorton, would you like to talk a little bit about the film?
Sure. And I wanted to thank both you and Chris for having Mike and I on the show tonight. We're honored to be part of it. The Skookum, the Hunt for Bigfoot was conceived probably 4 or 5 years ago. I used to drive through Falk, Arkansas on the way to work to Texarkana every day. And every time I'd drive through there down near Highway 71, I would just get chills up and down my spine because of the Falk Monster and the legend of Boggy Creek. I absolutely knew that that was a true story because of all the sightings and reports, and I would absolutely, I was riveted by it. The background in filmmaking, and have done a documentary film, and have had a feature script that was made into a feature film. So I was ready to tackle a feature film, a low-budget independent feature film. But I wanted it to be a horror film just because it's easier to sell foreign rights and that kind of thing. But the only thing, only subject that intrigued me was that of Bigfoot. And I probably watched The Legend of Boggy Creek 100 times if I've watched it once. One of the things that I love so much about it, it was based on a true story, reenactment scenes in the movie with most of the people that these events happened to in Falk, Arkansas. So I decided to go from there. I talked to a friend of mine who is the head of the Film Commission, Shreveport, Louisiana, Arlena Acree, and she had met Mike and heard his story and said, "You have got to meet Mike Woolley." So she put me in touch with him. When I heard his story, like I say, it was very compelling, believable, and I knew I wanted this person to be in the film, to lend authenticity to the project and loosely base the story on Mike's experience. You know, we embellish it, of course, because it is a narrative feature film, but we always stay true to the facts and what Mike reported, you know, his experience was. We did as much of that reenactment as possible in the film and then brought Mike in to play his own role. And of course, he was able to bring in Dr. Jeff Meldrum to the project, which lent itself to another area of authenticity and allowed us to, he actually was the script consultant as well as ended up playing a role based on his own role as a research scientist and arguably probably the most respected research scientist in the world. So he critiqued every draft of the script that we went through to make sure that what we presented was plausible. We didn't want a hokey slasher movie. We didn't want to be salacious. So we took our time to do this and develop the script for about, we spent about a year and a half to get it where we needed it to be. And then we started raising funds. And of course, like any other, you know, independent film project, several of those, that funding fell through before the third time was a charm. And we were able to slash the budget somewhat and raise the needed funds, kind of cobble the funds together from different areas to actually make the movie.
So you actually filmed this on location north of, well, actually the area near where this event actually occurred. How close to you were you in terms of location to the real events?
Well, that's a good question because we were originally going to shoot the movie when it was on a little higher budget, still a low budget film, but we were going to be getting more money than what we originally shot it, what we actually shot it on. So we were going to shoot it down near where in DeSoto Parish, Louisiana, which is south of Shreveport, Louisiana. Still, though, in the northern part of Louisiana, and heavily wooded area with a lot of water, and that near where Mike lives and has experience. But because of funding, it was too difficult and too costly to film it there. We didn't really have the facilities that we needed and the ease of accessibility. So we chose an area in, well, north of Shreveport, which is basically on the near the Texas line, Oil City, Louisiana, and Caddo Lake. And the reason we chose that is because of accessibility to what we needed to film. We had the facilities there, plus there have been numerous Bigfoot sightings in that area too. And so it lended itself, the location that we chose, even though it wasn't exactly where Mike's experience was, and I would say it's a good, at least, oh, I would say 60 miles, maybe plus, from where Mike had his encounter, but it was still close enough to, and gave us the terrain where we could film the way we wanted to film it for the budget that we were on, plus, again, there have been so many sightings in and around Caddo Lake, both on the Texas side and the Louisiana side. So we felt we'd get the authentic feel of an area that had we feel is inhabited by Bigfoot.
Do we actually get to see a glimpse of the Bigfoot in the movie, Debbie?
Oh, several times, actually, and a good glimpse, too. We spent a long time on the costume, but we also want to be in, and are working on this right now in post-production, last stretch of editing, to get the Bigfoot sounds exactly right. And actually, our one of our executive producers, who is a big Bigfoot researcher in his own right, as well as a filmmaker, Rob Godet, is actually rendering those Bigfoot sounds, and they're going to be exactly what people have reported and what people have recorded, what the researchers think actually Bigfoot sounds. So we're going to use that in the film, his sound mixes.
When is the final cut set to be finished, and when are you set to go into release, and what will be the venue of release for the film, Debbie?
We have some interest from the Sci-Fi Channel, and we would love for Sci-Fi to be able to purchase the license rights. We also, because of the advent of so many different venues, we may go with a hybrid approach to distribution, which calls for being able to keep our own rights to sell the DVDs and sell the downloads from, like, say, a venue like Vimeo, and be able to also sell license rights to different networks, and then foreign rights in addition to that.
Have you been doing any screenings at, like, conferences or events or film festivals?
I'm sure we will. I really... we had an experience back in October where we scheduled a couple of screenings, and all we had is a very rough cut, and the film was not where it needed to be. I mean, it was good that we got to see it on the big screen, because we saw, number one, how absolutely stunningly gorgeous the video is. The video is just beautiful, and the people that have seen it said, oh, I felt like I was right there. I felt like I was in a swamp in the woods with you guys, because we filmed it on a high quality digital camera, a Red Epic camera, which is basically the highest you can get, or close to the highest now that you can get as far as video quality. And then our sound was just superb. We had a great audio guy, and he just did a great job with his sound. So those two elements are there, We've got the acting is great, and Mike Woolley, both, and Jeff Meldrum were awesome, as well as our other actors and extras. And what we have to work on now to get it where we want it to be is just getting the editing right. There were some editing issues on the rough cut. It didn't have the rhythm and the flow that we ultimately want. So I'm not putting it out there. I'm not sending it to Sci-Fi yet or to any other network or venue until it is exactly where we want it to be. And like I said, it's taking longer than we wanted, but the important thing is to get it right. We do have on our website, we do have the opportunity for people to be involved in our test audience. If they're interested, they can go to www.skookumthemovie.com and go click on the news icon. And we're, for people that pre-order the director's cut DVD, they'll get a $5 discount on ultimately what the film will cost when it's released. And they get their name in the special credits on the end titles of the film, plus our Skookum fan page on Facebook and our website and our IMDb page. So it's a good way for to have a test audience, to get feedback from people, and to let people be a part, let our audience be a part of this filmmaking process.
So in a modest way, you're kind of crowdfunding it in that measure.
No, not really. We're not really crowdfunding it because, I mean, we did some of that on Indiegogo and GoFundMe, but we've already produced the film.
Right.
So we've already, I mean, we raised the budget that we needed for the film. Anything that comes in on that, on, you know, pre-sales right now won't go to that. It will go strictly as revenue on the film.
Okay, very good. Okay, so one more time for the website for the film, Debbie.
It is skookumthemovie.com, and the pre-order button for PayPal is on the news page, NEWS page. We do have a store that will be opening probably this weekend, but we couldn't get it quite ready by tonight, but it should be open, you know, by March 15th, 16th. So people can check back with that. But right now on the pre-order DVDs, they can get that on the news page. They can plug in Skookum, The Hunt for Bigfoot, to check out our IMDb page. And we've got a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/skookumthemovie.
Very good. I want to thank you both for coming on and sharing your adventure, Mike, your adventure over these many years of coming to grips with your encounter, and Debbie for kicking in tonight and producing a movie that hopefully is going to bring a little bit of legitimacy to the legacy of Bigfoot and help us all come to terms with what's really out there in the woods. Thanks so much for coming on, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Chris and Randy, I enjoyed it very much. My pleasure.
Thank you very much, guys.
Yes, thank you. It was very interesting. Very interesting, and I'm glad you were here today to tell us about it, Mike.
This is Off Planet Radio. Promises carved into a chasm wall. I remain hidden inside their world. Composed like bronze, I bend the knee before the sun that dives in the sea. When I die, fling my ashes high.